Hey, good morning, everybody. Really nice to see you. Christmas often is a time that we remember our loved ones, isn't it? Who are no longer with us. That's a thing. When the writer of the Bible book of Matthew wrote about Jesus' birth, he starts with recalling to his readers some of Jesus' ancestors. And he starts with naming the super popular King David and Abraham, symbols of a glorious past and of a glorious promise. So a few weeks ago, we heard about Sarah, Abraham's wife. Last week, Mouse and Judy told us about Tamar. And this week, we're hearing about another person in Jesus' whakapapa, who is described in Matthew's family tree, but without being named. So this is what Matthew says. The very start of the New Testament. Jesus Christ came from the family of King David and also from the family of Abraham. And this is a list of his ancestors. From Abraham to King David, his ancestors were Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Judah and his brothers. Judah's sons were Perez and Zerah, and their mother was Tamar. Tick. Hezron, Ram, Abinadab, Nashon, Salmon, Boaz, his mother was Rahab. Obed, his mother was Ruth, Jesse and King David. From David to the time of exile in Babylonia, the ancestors of Jesus were David, Solomon, his mother had been Uriah's wife. And I'm going to stop there. Uriah's wife had a name. And we know her name from parts of her life story being told. That is Bathsheba. And her story is one of turmoil, trauma, pain and grief. Great descriptors for a focus on peace, right? And yet in these, we also see resolve and courage and a determination for a better, brighter future. If you're a Game of Thrones fan, anyone out there Game of Thrones fan, Bathsheba's story here in the Bible book called 2 Samuel will not sound unfamiliar. Now, I'm not a Game of Thrones fan, but I was just told by someone who is that that would be quite fitting. So if it doesn't fit, tell me and I'll blame that person who told me. Sweet. So we're gonna hear the story from Lou. She's going to come and read the story for us. So thank you very much, Lou.
This is 2 Samuel chapter 11. It was now spring, the time when kings go to war. David sent out the whole Israelite army under the command of Joab and his officers. They destroyed the Ammonite army and surrounded the capital of Rabbah, but David stayed in Jerusalem. Late one afternoon, David got up from a nap and was walking around on the flat roof of his palace. A beautiful young woman was down below in her courtyard, bathing as her religion required. David happened to see her, and he sent one of his servants to find out who she was. The servant came back and told David, "Her name's Bathsheba. She's the daughter of Eliam, and she is the wife of Uriah the Hittite." David sent some messengers to bring her to his palace. She came to him, and he slept with her. Then she returned home. But later, when she found out that she was going to have a baby, she sent someone to David with this message, "I'm pregnant." David sent a message to Joab, "Send Uriah the Hittite to me." Joab sent Uriah to David's palace, and David asked him, "Is Joab well? How's the army doing? And how about the war?" Then David told Uriah, "Go home and clean up." Uriah left the king's palace and David had dinner sent to Uriah's house. But Uriah didn't go home. Instead, he slept outside the entrance to the royal palace, where the king's guards slept. Someone told David that Uriah had not gone home. So the next morning, David asked him, "Why didn't you go home? Haven't you been away for a long time?" Uriah answered, "The sacred chest and the armies of Israel and Judah are camping out somewhere in the fields with our commander Joab and his officers and troops." Do you really think I would go home and eat and drink and sleep with my wife? I swear by your life, I would not. Then David said, stay here in Jerusalem today, and I'll send you back tomorrow. Uriah stayed in Jerusalem that day. Then the next day, David invited him for dinner. Uriah ate with David, who gave him so much to drink that he got drunk. But Uriah still did not go home. He went out and slept on his mat near the palace guards. Early the next morning, David wrote a letter and told Uriah to deliver it to Joab. The letter said, put Uriah on the front line where the fighting is the worst. Then pull the troops back from him so that he will be wounded and die. Joab had been carefully watching the city of Rabbah, and he put Uriah in the place where he knew that there were some of the enemy's best soldiers. When the men of the city came out, they fought and killed some of David's soldiers. Uriah the Hittite was one of them. Joab sent a messenger to David to tell him everything that was happening in the war. He gave the messenger these orders. When you finish telling the king everything that happened, he may get angry and ask, why did you go so near to the city to fight? Didn't you know they would shoot arrows from the wall? Don't you know that Abimelech and the son of Gideon was killed at Thebez? Didn't a woman kill him by dropping a large rock from the top of the city wall? Why did you go so close to the city walls? Then tell him, one of your soldiers that was killed was Uriah the Hittite. The messenger went to David and reported everything that Joab had told him. And he added, the enemy chased us from the wall and out into the open fields, but we pushed them back as far as the city gate. Then they shot arrows at us from the top of the wall. Some of your soldiers were killed. One of them was Uriah the Hittite. David replied, tell Joab to cheer up, not be too upset about what happened. You never know who will be killed in a war. Tell him to strengthen his attack against the city and break through its walls. When Bathsheba heard that her husband was dead, she mourned for him. Then after the time of mourning was over, David sent someone to bring her to his palace. She became David's wife, and they had a son.
Thank you, Lou. So, in about 3 days, Bathsheba's world turned upside down in the most traumatic of ways. Perved on, abducted and assaulted in the worst way, her loyal husband betrayed and killed by her abuser, and whilst mourning him, she's abducted again to become yet another conquest wife of dastardly David. Pain, pain, pain. Certainly not peace. And certainly not consent. Consent is giving permission for something to happen. So, for example, because everyone is different, some people love to hug, and some people can't stand hugs. And each person gets to decide what they're comfortable with. So can a hug-loving person just start hugging people at random? Nope. They need consent, right? And how do we know if we have consent? We ask. It can be simple like, would you like a hug? Yes, I would. Can I hold your hand? I'd rather not. Okay. If a person doesn't say yes, can I hug you? Then they haven't really given their consent. It's pretty simple. Ask for consent, listen to their answer. If a person bribes or threatens you to say yes, that's not consent. It's important that we are a church that practices consent seeking. It can feel awkward asking for a hug or to put a hand on a shoulder before praying. But it's important. If any person here, especially younger people, you know, feel that they've been treated badly by someone, you know, we want to hear from you. We hope you can be brave because we don't want people to be getting hurt and seeking out help. Speaking up helps problems to be addressed. So you can talk to a parent, to a leader, to anybody else that you trust, because we want everyone to be safe and to be at peace. Back to Bathsheba. And what we've heard so far is what most people know. Oh, I forgot to click through my slides. Sorry. I'm not sure where I'm up to. Next one. Oh, yeah, that's the consent one. That could stay there for a little bit. You right to do that, Tim? Thank you. Yeah, cheers. So back to the sheep, Bathsheba. What we've heard so far is what most people know of her. But how did she survive and thrive and end up as Jesus' ancestor and being a bringer of peace? African-American pastor and theologian Will Gaffney imagines that in the white space surrounding these black-inked words on the pages of our Bibles, that perhaps Bathsheba made up her mind to have the best life she could under the circumstances. Perhaps she said to David something like, "You are not going to shut me up like you did to your first wife, Michal. You stole the life I had with my husband in the sight of God, the man I love, the husband I chose to live with. You stole our future and you stole our children. I can't get that back, but I can make the most of my life and have your children and gain the security that comes with them. I will be mother of the future king." And as I read this text, I wonder who came alongside Bathsheba in those early day, dark days. Perhaps it was Nathan, pictured here at the back. The prophet who at great risk stood up to David and helped him to see what he had done was wrong. And doesn't the world need more Nathans who will stand up for people who have been abused? Bathsheba ended up naming one of her children after Nathan. So time passes, and David is on his deathbed here. And there's a heap of confusion over who would be the next king. Nathan and Bathsheba on the kneeling there, Nathan and Bathsheba team up because David's fourth and now elder son, Adonijah, is declaring himself the new king. And so they hatch a plan. Bathsheba goes to David and speaks to his pride, saying, "Aren't you still the king? Why is it that Adonijah can proclaim himself king while you're still alive?" She reminds David that Adonijah will surely kill her and son Solomon and the rest of her children along with David. Then, just as planned, Nathan walks in and Bathsheba slips out of the room. Nathan says pretty much the same thing. David comes to his senses, calls Bathsheba back in and says to her, "I promised you that I would make Solomon king, and I'm going to keep my word." And so at that very moment, David proclaimed Solomon to be king. And then David dies. And so the partying and the scheming Adonijah realizes that he's on shaky ground. He's in trouble. So he comes to Bathsheba to make an audacious request that she asks the new King Solomon if he can marry one of his dad's trophy women, the one there on the left. Bathsheba, having brought Solomon up with kingly duties in mind, has a good idea where this would end and agrees and approaches her son and king to ask for Adonijah's request. Solomon sees right through the request as an attempt to grab the throne off Solomon. See you later, Adonijah. It's a bit of an awful text, really, isn't it? I mean, there's so much violence in it and throughout the Bible. And it's simply reflecting the reality that God met people where they were, which was in that time, in the Iron Age. What, about 1000 BC? And yet the irony is that like 3,000 years later, we still use power, don't we, to hurt people and to kill people. Maybe not us specifically killing, but this sort of power doesn't last and it does not bring peace. God is still trying to show the Davids of this world that just because they have the power, it doesn't mean they can do what they want. And what I find fascinating in Bathsheba's story is how, when David has died, we see her not just surviving, but thriving. She's using her agency, her ability to make decisions for herself, There's a restoring work taking place in her life. When Bathsheba chooses to approach Solomon for Adonijah's request, we read in 1 Kings chapter 2, verse 19, that the king rose to meet her and bowed down to her. Then he sat on his throne and had a throne brought for the king's mother. And she sat on his right. Bathsheba, standing there, becomes the right-hand woman in the kingdom. How different this is from her first encounter with an Israelite king. Instead of being forced underneath, she is now voluntarily elevated above. Bathsheba is no longer the broken woman used by David, for God has brought transformation. She's been given back her power, and even more than she could imagine. She is restored. And how did Bathsheba and Solomon use their power? Their kingdom is marked by peace. Next slide. Will Gaffney points out that it can be tempted to say that there is a reason for everything and that everything happens for a reason and that everything happens for our good. It can be easy to say that. We've probably all heard that. There are better ways. There are better ways to see this dynamic at work. God can transform any situation and restore brokenness. But God does not need us to be broken. God does not need us to be devastated or abused to elevate us, to use us, to restore us. It's true that Bathsheba would not have had Solomon if David had not kidnapped and badly abused her. It's true that she would not have had this life that she had, but we will never know what kind of life she and Uriah would have had. Perhaps, you know, just perhaps, Uriah would have risen up through the ranks of David's army. And when David died, one of David's foolish sons makes a mess out of the kingdom, then Uriah could have stepped in and stepped up, making Bathsheba the right-hand woman without all the mess. It could happen. And, you know, in fact, it did happen. This is what happened with the army general and his wife after Solomon died. And one of his foolish sons makes a mess out of the kingdom. The army general became the king in his place. Bathsheba made the best out of a situation full of turmoil. And God was with her. And God helped bring peace in her family, in her nation. Bathsheba, subjected to the opposite of peace, becomes a peacemaker. And it reminds us of her descendant, the Prince of Peace, Jesus, the Light of Peace. Jesus entered our messy world with extreme vulnerability, not wanted by extended family, becoming an unnamed immigrant, falsely accused, given an unfair trial, beaten, betrayed, mocked, killed. And yet through his life and resurrection, millions have experienced peace in their hearts amidst turmoil, real turmoil, due to God's very peacemaking heart, which brings peace to people through the Spirit. And so may God, the restorer of broken hearts, minds, and bodies, accompany us through the brokenness in our lives, nurturing, sustaining, and transforming us to bring peace in our lives, in our families, in our nation, and to the world. Amen.